Have you ever been told you're crazy? How about hysterical? If you're a woman, you may have noticed the medical establishment hasn't always taken your symptoms seriously. That was certainly true in the past, and if it's gotten better, it's thanks to practitioners like Elizabeth Comen, the author of the new book, All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. Elizabeth is a medical oncologist specializing in treating breast cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. Here she is to share the key insights from her book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Comen. I'm a medical oncologist specializing in treating breast cancer. I'm privileged to have treated thousands of women with breast cancer over the years. I'm also passionate about the history of medicine. Medicine doesn't exist in a vacuum, after all, but is deeply intertwined with religion, culture, and politics. I wrote All in Her Head to help heal women's medical past and explain why old narratives about women's bodies continue to haunt women today and impact how girls and women feel about their bodies, what medical research is conducted, and what care is available to all of us, including myself. Here are five insights from my book. Insight number one, you are not crazy. There is a reason why my book title, All in Her Head, resonates with many women. It's because so many of us have heard it before. Time and time again, I validate for my patients that their medical concerns are real, their pain is real, their symptoms are real, and not, as they may have heard, all in their head. Across the board, including today, there's boundless evidence and a rising public tidal wave finally acknowledging just how misunderstood, invalidated, and at times unheard far too many women feel in our healthcare system. A recent study showed that more than one in three women felt that a doctor either did not believe them, made incorrect assumptions about them, or blamed them for a health problem. And in my world in particular, these experiences can lead to a serious delayed diagnosis or misdiagnosis. Medicine has a long history of calling women crazy, especially hysterical. In fact, the specter of the hysterical woman has infiltrated nearly all aspects of women's health, even to the present. Throughout medical history, the consensus was that simply having a uterus put any woman at a biological disadvantage, as this temperamental organ could not help but impact the workings of the brain. Did you know that the word hysteria comes from the Greek word for womb? And reading famous texts by ancient Greek physicians, including Hippocrates, one would think that the uterus wandered around the body, sowing chaos everywhere, and was responsible for innumerable medical problems in women. Throughout history, a version of the hysteria diagnosis would shift to whatever was in vogue at the time, whether it be demonic possession during the medieval era or the anxious housewife in the 1970s. And this meant extreme, often barbaric treatments for women. For example, in the late 19th century, hysteria as a diagnosis really got a boost from one of the most famous founding fathers of the field of neurology, Dr. Jean-Martin Charcot, who practiced in Paris. Now, we certainly have him to thank for laying the groundwork for our understanding of many diseases of the nervous system, such as multiple sclerosis. But when it came to what he termed the hysterical patient, he had an entire ward of largely women that he would parade in a weekly demonstration. Side note, Sigmund Freud was sometimes in the audience. And during these demonstrations, he would hypnotize women to perform degrading acts and even recommended at times violent treatments. And in the 1940s, a doctor, Walter Freeman, advanced a procedure called the lobotomy, whereby he used an ice pick through the eye socket to sever certain ties in the brain. He claimed to be able to treat everything from insomnia to anxiety. Not surprisingly, some women died from the procedure, and many more had irreversible brain damage. So next time you hear a woman called hysterical or crazy, particularly in the medical setting, think about where this word comes from and what they might be really implying. Insight number two. As the science of medicine advanced, women were sidelined. In the 1800s and prior, an ancient theory called humorism governed how doctors treated patients, whereby they believed the body was a balance of four humors: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. Medicine was not codified as a profession the way it is today, and many doctors may not have even gone to medical school as we know it. But that changed over the 19th century, and those changes particularly affected women. For much of human history, the health of women was primarily a woman's issue, as women were tended to by other women in the family and often midwives, who had generations worth of specialized knowledge about women's bodies. But as medicine underwent a scientific revolution and formalized in the mid-1800s with the rise of germ theory and increased scientific knowledge about the body, it spawned its own institutions, hierarchies, and specialized fields of research, like our modern-day system of cardiology and gastroenterology. Midwives were increasingly sidelined and scorned by the system as uneducated practitioners of folk medicine. Medical schools became a place for learning about medicine in the United States, and women were primarily shut out of attending them. Women who had long been the primary custodians of knowledge about the medical issues that impact women specifically found themselves relegated to the fringes. Medicine began to fracture into the system of specialization that still exists today, as doctors began to conceive of patients less as whole people than as an amalgamation of systems and body parts. A consensus took hold within the medical community that women were much too fragile, nervous, and discombobulated to become doctors. And within a single generation, a seismic shift had taken place. Women were systematically shut out at the very moment that the field of medicine was beginning to advance by leaps and bounds, deprived of the opportunity not only to contribute their own knowledge, but to share in the discovery of new science. For example, doctors in the mid-1800s took over the age-old duties of female midwives and became the primary stakeholders of this new field they called, quote-unquote, gynecology. One specific example of the consequence of the exclusion of women and the fracturing of the body into specialties involves when the medical community seemed to forget that women need to pee too. For example, the American Urological Association was founded in 1902. When most people think about the field of urology, they think of male doctors and male patients, a specialty devoted to men's genitalia. And yet, there are so many urological conditions that are predominant in women. I recall seeing a sign in a public woman's bathroom at a sporting event advertising for resources at an academic hospital. It read, "Your man spending too much time in the bathroom? Weak urinary flow can be an early sign for prostate cancer. Get him checked." Now imagine the reverse campaign for women who have incontinence after childbirth. Can you even imagine a sign like this in a men's bathroom? Is your woman urinating on herself when she runs? She doesn't have to. Get her help. Among the many areas of medicine that seem to forget about women, is it really that surprising that countless women suffer from treatable urological conditions, not knowing that there's an entire field of medicine dedicated to helping them too? Insight number three, women's health is not just bikini medicine. The discussion around women's health is so often focused on our breasts and reproductive anatomy, bikini medicine, if you will, but that of course does not encompass the totality of our health. The insidious incuriosity about other aspects of women's health and how they may differ from men has limited our understanding of many disease presentations, including those that are predominant in women. Here are some examples. Number one, 80% of autoimmune diseases are in women, affecting over 50 million women in the United States alone. But we don't consider this a woman's health issue. Number two, a woman's risk of Alzheimer's is significantly higher than men, almost 2 times greater than the risk for men. And yet our understanding of the disease and funding for research for the disease is woefully limited. Number three, cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of women in the United States. Yet when I was in medical school, I was taught that the way a woman presents with chest pain and a heart attack is often atypical when compared to a man. But how are women atypical in their symptoms when we are greater than 50% of the population? And in fact, only 1/3 of clinical trials for heart disease properly include women. Indeed, the heavy focus on bikini medicine has meant that women were often excluded from critical clinical trials. It's only been since 1993 that women were even required to be included in clinical trials. Some of the landmark trials of aspirin and cholesterol drugs, for example, included thousands of men and not a single woman. And then when we did include women, including in recent history, sometimes we still really missed the mark. For example, when the COVID vaccine came out, many women anecdotally reported unexpected menstrual changes. But menstruation wasn't included as an endpoint in any of the clinical trials for the COVID vaccine, despite this being an important metric that many women use as a marker for their health. It was only after a study spearheaded by female scientists, after they themselves started questioning their own menstrual patterns after the vaccine, that a study validated the anecdotal experience in women after the vaccine. 71% of women on birth control and 66% of postmenopausal women reported breakthrough bleeding within 2 weeks of being vaccinated. Ultimately, the incuriosity of medicine about diseases beyond bikini medicine means that we are still so far from gender parity in medicine. Insight number four, women's sexual desire, the fear and control of it, has underscored nearly every aspect of the history of women's health. When researching women's medical history, I was astounded by just how often men either prescribe sex as a treatment for a woman's medical problem, with only their husband, of course, for everything from hysteria to a type of anemia during the Victorian era called chlorosis. Or alternatively, doctors blamed and claimed that female desire and even worse, masturbation was to blame for a remarkable litany of medical problems. From scoliosis to incontinence to anemia, some element of female sexuality infiltrated all of women's medical ailments. For example, at the turn of the 19th century, Dr. Robert Tuttle Morris, a surgeon and one of the founders of the Endocrinology Society, claimed that a woman's masturbatory habits could lead to laziness, which in turn would lead to curvature of the spine. Another example was a truly horrific condition that women would apparently suffer from at the turn of the 19th century if they rode a bike. This was called bicycle face. Bicycle face was a diagnosis that doctors said women would have if they rode a bicycle, wherein their faces would become frozen in a horrible grimace from the exertion of riding a bicycle, not to mention the extreme distortion of their bodies with bulky, grotesque muscles. Now, this boogie woman patient actually never existed, never showed up in a doctor's office, but it didn't stop physicians from weighing in that women should not ride a bicycle. It would be bad for their health. According to doctors of the time, the worst of the damage, however, was hidden in their pants. The patient's labia would harden as a result of repeated bruising by the bicycle seat, pushing her reproductive organs into disarray. Furthermore, doctors claimed that women could and would use the bicycle to masturbate. The sexually exciting nature of bicycle seats made for a remarkable example of the medical establishment reaching a conclusion before doing any research, and writing off the woman who contradicted their assumptions as untrustworthy liars. One Dr. Robert Dickinson, a famous gynecologist, wrote in 1895 that he could find no cases in which riding a bike turned a woman into a chronic masturbator. But this didn't sway him from his belief that all possible steps should be taken to prevent this from happening. Quote, "It is perfectly conceivable that under certain conditions, the bicycle saddle could both engender and propagate this horrible habit," end quote. Now, are we really so surprised that when it came to actually addressing women's sexual health and satisfaction throughout history, the medical establishment was largely silent? When you look at medical textbooks throughout history, men claim to have discovered, then ignored, lost, and rediscovered the clitoris. Really? Somehow, it wasn't until 2005 that a female urologist actually mapped the entirety of the clitoris. When women are polled today, over 40% of women have a sexual health concern. Is it not surprising then that in my field of oncology, oncologists are 2 times more likely to ask male patients about sexual side effects from medication than women? Sadly, throughout medical history, women have been told a similar message when it comes to their sexuality and desire. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't, and that remains a damn shame. Number five, it is possible to partner with an imperfect healthcare system. First, I get it. I really get it. Yes, I'm a doctor, but I'm also a daughter, a mother, a friend, and a patient myself. At the end of writing this book, ironically, I had an unexpected complication from a surgery and suffered longer than I should have because I too struggled with advocating for myself, a function of so many of the issues I'm trying to course correct in this book. I minimized my pain, I apologized, and I didn't want to bother anyone on my care team. And yet, there are some concrete ways to navigate what is at times a broken healthcare system. First, Try to include an ally in your healthcare team, a friend, a loved one, a family member, someone who can take notes and be another set of eyes and ears in doctor's appointments, especially if you have a new diagnosis or are particularly anxious. Come prepared with questions if you can. Number two, establish who are the key players on your healthcare system. In today's medical system, sometimes that could include a nurse and a nurse practitioner. Understanding who does what on the medical team can really optimize communication. Number three, clarify how you want information communicated to you. The recent Cures Act means that you may receive medical results before even your doctor has seen them. Clarify with your doctor how you want to receive information, as medical data without professional context can be very scary and misleading. Number four, if you don't like your doctor or think they don't like you, don't stick it out. Move on. Number five, remember you deserve to feel healthy and good in your body. Your healthcare concerns matter. And if you do like your doctor, trust them with what really matters to you and perhaps even what really scares you. Chances are they entered medicine with a deep desire to help, and in trusting them with your concerns, this will lead to better care for you all around. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy my book and it helps you meaningfully embrace the health you wish to have for yourself and generations to come.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was five big ideas from All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today, by Elizabeth Komen. You might also like our book by four, The Pain Gap, How Sexism and Racism in Healthcare Kill Women, by Anousheh Hossain. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.